What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Yakwe, kia ora na, tālo for love and good morning. It's Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Tupol. And coming up on the show, Samoa's Prime Minister is a no-show for his own criminal trial. PNG Prime Minister is in Australia set to sign the Puk Puk Treaty and Tuvalu and Kiribati fighting to be official members of the Oceania Football Confederation. All that and more, but as always, we'd like to give acknowledgement to the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation known as Melbourne. So thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Samoa, where Parliament will meet today for the first session since the FAST party was voted into office. But the man of the moment, Prime Minister Lauli Alemaliatua, Leotea Politei Val Fossi Schmidt, won't be there. He is still in New Zealand receiving urgent medical treatment. He'll also miss the first day of his own criminal trial, which is also starting today. Adele Fruin is the ABC's reporter in Apia, and I spoke to her earlier as she made her way to court for today's hearing. Adele, it's quite an extraordinary situation, the Prime Minister to have his first day in Parliament, but he's also got to go on trial today. What are Samoans making of this situation?
Now, first of all, the Prime Minister is still not in the country at the moment. He will be back until the 19th of October, so he won't be at Parliament and he won't be at court today. However, with what's happening now, everybody is concentrating on what his next moves are in terms of court cases. But while he has gone to the public and made public statements that he will still respect the court processes and will accept any verdict. Today, however, I'm here at Parliament. It's being held at the gymnasium exactly where the swearing ceremony held. Today, the FAST government will table their first budget. That will be the main event today. Now, of course, yes, today is also the Prime Minister's case, but not on individual charges. He's joining five others in the conspiracy charges. You know, Lauli Alemaliatua was charged with conspiring or attempting to pervert cause of justice and also conspiracy to commit an offence. Now, today will be submissions from all of their lawyers, so that's going to take a while, I would say.
Now, the Law Society has taken the PM to task over his appointment as police minister. What was the concern?
The main concern of the Samoa Law Society, you know, issued through a statement directed to the Prime Minister, Lauli Alemaliatua, is the fact that he holds ministerial roles such as the Attorney General's Office and also the Minister of Police. Now, they've noted that, yes, he holds these positions, but important to note that he's been charged with several criminal charges, basically. And to ensure the independence, transparency, and impartiality of the country's justice system, they just hope he will not interfere with the process. But, of course, the Attorney General's office in the Prime Minister's defence issued a response also to not only welcome the concern by the Law Society, but also reassure them that the Prime Minister, despite being the Minister of Police and the Attorney General's office, has not interfered with the court's process. They also noted that the Prime Minister himself made a public statement reassuring that he is allowing the court proceedings to take its course.
The new FAST government, right, they've been in office for a couple of weeks now. What does the public want from them?
There's both an excitement and high expectations from members of the public over what they hope the new government would prioritise. Now, I spoke to some or know Samoans, and here's what they have to say.
The government should prioritise our healthcare system. There's not enough doctors, nurses and hospitals to cater to more than 200,000 people.
I want the government to put the needs of our people first. They should empower our people economically with opportunities.
I only want the government to prioritise the high cost of living. Our people are struggling with how expensive everything is. If they really care about the people, then that should be their priority.
Adele, it's been over a year since the New Zealand Navy vessel sank in Samoa, right? There are reports of a compensation deal. Has there been any more information from the Samoan government?
So far, there have not been any information released so far in terms of the compensation deal between Samoa and New Zealand. Now, the new government has yet to announce how much, the villagers that have been affected will be compensated for. But I do recall the former Prime Minister, Fiaminari Mataafa, revealed that, yes, there is compensation for the villagers, but right now it was up to the new government to distribute that and also to make known of how much each village and also constituency will be getting. While the news of compensation comes as relief for villagers, I've spoken to the village chief and they only wished they were part of the conversations of how, the money will be distributed or what sort of compensation, each of them will be receiving. Because while, the constituencies that have been affected, it's quite a lot of them, right? But main village affected is Takitoala. So they have the biggest concern of just how much, if priority will be given to them since they have been the most affected.
And that is Adele Fruin, ABC's reporter in Samoa. Now, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, James Marape, is in Australia for the signing of the Puk Puk Treaty. A statement from the Prime Minister's office says Mr. Marape will sign off on the treaty this week, although an exact day and time was not specified. Once signed, the new treaty opens the door to 10,000 Papua New Guinean soldiers to join the Australian Defence Force as the two countries integrate their military forces. Mr. Marape in a statement says the new treaty will fine-tune security relations with Australia. Now, the PNG Cabinet approved the text of the treaty late last week, clearing the way for the leaders of PNG and Australia to sign off on the Puk Puk Treaty. The ABC's reporter in PNG, Belinda Cora, spoke to Papua New Guineans on the street of the capital Port Moresby on their views on the deal.
From a personal point of view, I see that the treaty, like for the past 50 years, we've come true. As a developing country, I don't think the treaty is okay for us because we are a developing country, not a developed country. So I believe the government doesn't have to go on with the treaty with Australia because as we're a developing country, we will rely on Australia as well as Japan, China, for that matter. And to sign the treaty for those countries, it won't be a good image to them because they're also investing in Papua New Guinea.
I, for one, as a Papua New Guinean, believe that the Puk Treaty, it would be good for the country, mainly because it would uplift the skill sets, meaning the technical and the soft skill area for the military. That would uplift the defense standard to world standard, and we, PNG, as a country, can be recognized if treaty is signed with transparency.
Would be of benefit to the country, especially in a very fast geopolitical world. It would be of benefit to the country in terms of upskilling of our security in human resource side of it, and also with infrastructure. It would be of benefit to the country. Just making reference to what our forefathers in the establishment state of the country, what they stood on was the policy of friends to all and enemies to none. As a Papua New Guinean looking at it on that angle or in that perspective, I would say it would be nice to be on neutral ground.
And that's the ABC reporter in Port Moresby, Belinda Cora, speaking to Everyday Papua New Guineans about the new security treaty with Australia.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Whaftai tere lava, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. Well, it's been more than 2 years since the wildfires destroyed the town of Lahaina, killing over 100 people. Now, since then, the island of Maui in Hawaii has experienced a surge in mental illnesses, with reports of a sharp increase in suicides and high rates of depression among survivors of the Lahaina wildfires. Our reporter, Whinau Whonua, spoke to mental health professionals on Maui, who say the crisis is only getting worse.
The August 2023 wildfires caused damage to people's homes, but the flames also left behind unseen damage. A new study found suicides and drug overdose deaths rose by nearly 50% statewide after the fires.
That was a news report from the island's news TV station last month, reporting on a new study revealing a rise in suicides and overdoses on Maui Island. It highlights a mental health crisis in Maui.
There's a big mental health epidemic happening in Lahaina.
DeAndre Makakoa is one of the organizers of Lahaina Strong, an NGO established after the disaster to advocate for the rights and needs of the community. He says the mental health crisis is serious, and that there's been a rise in suicides and overdoses.
That type of trauma is really heavy, and it's a huge burden for people to go through. And, you know, not to mention some of what people saw during the fires. And this is, you know, hearsay, anecdotal, but there's probably at least one suicide a month.
On the outskirts of Lahaina, there's an unusual sight of goats standing on people stretched out in yoga poses.
With having the goats there, much like having any therapy animal, it just sort of calms them down.
Yoga master Kim Winsung is the founder of Goat Yoga Lahaina, which offers an alternative service of rehabilitation using goats. Miss Winsung says the new yoga style helps survivors of the Lahaina wildfires by connecting them with animals.
The goats are making you laugh, sharing their energy with you. They have little antics and tricks that they do. The goats will jump on people's back, and then they get in sort of a free back massage too, because the goats kind of just know where to stay to feel grounded.
Living outside of Lahaina, Miss Winsung avoided the devastation of the wildfires. She's had to comfort her friends and neighbors whose homes were destroyed in Lahaina, and many of them are still homeless, waiting for homes promised to them by the government.
And we offer discounts to the community, and we've also worked with some women's fitness groups in the community, and some schools. Hawaii Technology Academy has come for field trips for their Earth Day and wellness.
Hawaii's 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is struggling to meet surging demand after the Lahaina fires.
I would say we're 2 years out of it, and the stresses have compounded. I've had more people coming to me the last few months.
Lahaina therapist Annie Vance says the slow recovery process is a mental burden for Lahaina survivors already traumatized by the wildfires. She says patients cite the stress of being unemployed and waiting for a house to be built, waiting for a home to be built.
Some people are in overwhelm because they have so much to do. They have been shuffled from hotel to hotel to hotel. The children are at risk because if the parents are not good and still living in temporary housing, that's causing a lot of stress on the children. And people in the emergency services, ambulance services, and the police department and all that.
Miss Vance herself faced the trauma of the wildfires. Her home was destroyed. The experience gives her the strength to connect with her patients. Like many, she says authorities haven't done enough to address the crisis, with survivors living under the stress of financial despair.
I spent my first 9 months moving to different hotels, and because I had a condo where there's a homeowner's fee, I had to continue paying, even though my place was burnt flat. It concerns me because it's like a slow, insipid way of just kind of people going into despair.
And that was Whenau Whanua with that report there.
Hold the front page!
Malo Lele. And welcome back to Pacific Beat. Of course, this is the time where we head around the region to get your latest headlines. And of course, that's always brought to you by our producer, Kyle Evans, who's joining me this Monday morning in the studio. How you doing? You had a good weekend?
Oh, great weekend, Aggie. It's this day every year where I question why the NRL lawmakers decided to put the grand final on Sunday nights when I have
right?
to work early
that's
on Monday
right.
morning. It seems like a cruel thing to do, but no, wonderful one nonetheless.
Yeah, well, we'll get to talk about that very shortly. But firstly, we're starting in Samoa, where there actually has been a deal that has been struck over compensation for the Manawanui disaster.
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. If you can believe it, that it was, but it was exactly 12 months ago today that the disaster took place when that ship ran aground off the coast of Opolu. Since then, we've seen salvage and recovery efforts take place, investigations, there's been oil fears, all of which led to that decision that the ship was ultimately not recoverable and would stay there essentially for eternity. Village elders, though, have long sought compensation for the damage to the reef and to the losses of fishing and just access to the area in general, not to mention tourism. RNZ is reporting this morning that an agreement has now been reached to deliver that compensation to the people out there.
Okay. Well, have there been details, though, of the compensation that's been released yet?
So, yeah, no details other than that for now, unfortunately, Aggie. However, a spokesperson from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, this is in New Zealand, said details would be released at some point today, or more details, but they do want to leave it to the Samoan government to announce the compensation. What we do know is the compensation is based on a survey which has been carried out over the last number of months, and that's basically formed the basis of that compensation. So that's now been finalised. So it's just a matter of time, and before we hear about that and sort of starting that implementation process.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, let's head to Palau now. They've managed to avoid a government shutdown against all odds. What's happening here?
Yeah, that's right. You might remember, I think it was Wednesday last week when we spoke about this, but yes. A government shutdown looked all but imminent when President Sarangawips Jr. stated that they'd failed to pass a national budget amid a standoff between Palau's two legislative chambers. That would have meant that the government was unable to spend money, placing risks to government operations, employees, as well as essential services. However, lawmakers at the final hour bought the government some time after rushing to pass a three-month stopgap budget, which will allow the government to continue operations up until December 31. However, they're not out of the woods. It does underscore a reoccurring problem of delayed budget approvals, which, not for the first time, Aggie, has left the country very vulnerable at critical moments.
Well, Kyle, why couldn't they pass the budget, though?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, I suppose it's like all budgets. Sarangawips Jr., he proposed a $152 million budget for 2026 back in September. Unfortunately, it wasn't accepted by the Senate. When the Senate then returned their own version of the budget, it contained a number of changes and shifted priorities, which obviously the House then rejected. And from then, it was just unfortunately a series of delays, which ultimately saw the government just run out of time. So luckily, the government does have now 3 months to solve those issues and hopefully avoid another funding crisis.
Absolutely. Okay, now we head to sport because, yes, there was the grand final that I'm sure many of you would have tuned into for the ages in the final game of the NRL season last night. Let's have a bit of a listen.
They've got probably one play to win it. Munster, McDonald, Grant, Meany, Katoa. The siren's about to go. This could be it. It's all over. It's been 19 years, but the Broncos are back on top of the rugby league world.
Yeah.
It was a cracking game, Aggie. Did you get a chance to watch it?
I watched the whole thing. I was bitterly disappointed that my Storm team didn't win, but that's okay.
Look, I'm not the biggest Broncos fan myself, I've got to say. But I will say that was probably the best grand final I think I've seen in terms of entertainment, at least since that 2015 grand final, when the North Queensland Cowboys beat the Broncos. Mm. But it was incredible. I mean, the Storm looked like they virtually had it won at halftime, leading 22-12. They looked just completely in control of that game, but I mean, incredibly didn't score a try in the second half and went on to lose 26-22. As you would know, Aggie, it was Reece Walsh who was well and truly the man in that game, and almost single-handedly kept the Broncos in it, scoring that incredible individual try and setting up a number of others. But I think it was that game-saving tackle he made in the dying minutes which really just solidified for me what was one of the great grand final performances by a single player. So no surprises that he won the Clive Churchill medal. And when you throw in the fact that the Broncos lost both their playmakers in Ben Hunt and Adam Reynolds, I mean, the fact that they grinded out that win in such dominant fashion, yeah, it truly was one of the great grand final performances. No surprises, but Pacific fingerprints all over the match. We reported on Friday that more than half the players on the field were actually of Pacific Islander or of Māori heritage. Tonga and Samoa internationals, Dene Marina and Elisa Katoa, both scored tries. And who could forget, obviously, Payne Haas, who was a workhorse all night. he actually spoke to NRL.com after the game, and here's what he had to say.
Sorry, part of these boys. Everyone counted us out all week, and they gave Storm, you know, every chance to win, but, you know, we stuck solid, mate, and the journey we've been on all together, from a wooden sprint to this now, oh, I can't believe it.
And your career personally, this is the one you wanted and you finally got it. How does it feel for you?
Mate, this is everything I wanted. I didn't care about individual accolades, I just wanted a ring, and to get it now, feels so good. I can't wait to enjoy this with everyone.
How's your legs? You've put in a massive performance week on week.
Yeah, a bit sore today. I think I copped the injury in my first run, but we'll see what happens. But I'm just going to enjoy this now, and, yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, so huge performance from him, and geez, what a couple of weeks for the city of Brisbane as well.
I must say, right? We've got the AFL, and then even the women beforehand.
Yes,
the NRLW. So shout out to the ladies for coming through and winning too.
Yes, no, I'm glad you brought them up actually. Yes. But just an incredible night of football all up. I've got
it really
to say,
it was a good game despite the Storm. But I must say, they did put up a good fight, I think, to be in the finals at least.
The Northern dominance, unfortunately, we're quite used to that in the sport of rugby league, and with the state of origin, it's it really tells that tale. But alas, until next season, Aggie.
That's right. So, as always, Carl, thank you very much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tini Rau Arona.
Now, the Arona Cup, Sharks versus the Roosters, I did say that.
Arona Cup every week, man. Honestly, yeah, just the grand final of the week. I swear, I don't know how many times we play for this cup.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nissan Bolivianak and welcome back to Pacific Beat. While they're known as narco subs, flat low profile boats used by drug cartels to smuggle illicit drugs across international borders. Over the past year, a handful of these boats have been turning up abandoned in the Pacific with no trace of their crew or illicit cargo. And just over the weekend, one such vessel was discovered floating in the ocean by villagers in Solomon Islands. So for more on this story, we're joined by reporter Ronald Toitoona from In Depth Solomons, an investigative news agency in Honiara. With that, I say good morning, Ronald.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah.
Thank
you for joining us. Well, how was this latest narco sub discovered?
The first two found and the dead now. It's been making headlines in Honiara and the rural areas.
Well, Ronald, for our listeners who might not know, you know, what's commonly referred to as a narco sub, can you just sort of describe what it looks like?
A narco sub is a drug submarine, some would say. It's a low-profile, semi-submersible vessel designed to avoid radar detection while carrying illegal drugs across international waters. They are usually made from fiberglass or metal. It's around 10 to 15 meters long. The latest one is 7.6 meters long and 2.4 meters wide, to be exact. These vessels ride just above the surface, often painted green, blue or gray to blend with the sea and, notoriously hard to spot.
Now, I understand, Ronald, you've been in touch with the villagers, right, who found this vessel. Well, can you tell us what did they find on board?
Yes, I spoke with the two men who towed the vessel to shore. It took them about 3 to 4 hours because it's filled with water. When they had to drive offshore, it took them around, the distance was around half a kilometer. So, when they climbed aboard, they found the engines were gone, already removed. They're suggesting that the vessel had been deliberately abandoned. Inside, they can discover plastic materials and liquid substances in bottles. That's what they found.
Well, then, do we know what will happen to this boat now, then?
They had plans to report to the police. I think they must have done that already. But from past experiences with the two boats that were found earlier, the first one, police have done, they have visited that scene, did some investigations, but then they never came back to the guy that who found the first one. And the second one was, the police were informed. They also did investigations, but we haven't heard anything back from them yet.
That is Ronald Toitona, a reporter with In-Depth Solomons, an online investigative news agency. We are talking about discovery of narco subs that have been found out in the Pacific. Well, Ronald, there's been a total of 3 discoveries in Solomon Islands. Where were the other 2 narco subs discovered?
The first one was found August of 2024, last year. It was found by a medical doctor, Reginald Ipia, in the Ontong Java Atolls, that's in the Malaita Outer Islands. It's around 400 kilometers from where the second boat was found. It was in Isabel in July this year.
And will it, well, what will actually happen to this latest narco sub? Like, will it be kept by the community or will it be destroyed?
Like I've said, based on previous cases, police are expected to secure the vessel and hand it over to people for investigations. But typically, this kind of vessel, are often left to the locals. That's from past experiences.
Yeah. And Ronald, speaking of police, I mean, have they actually issued any statements about this latest discovery?
So far, there hasn't been any official police statement yet, but I assume investigations are continuing.
Right. Well, I know you will be keeping us across that, but look, that's all the time that we have for this morning, Ronald. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
All good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That is Ronald Toitona, reporter with the In-Depth Solomons here on Pacific Beat. Pacific Beat. Yes, well, Zala Falava, what a morning it's been so far. Look, we just want to give a quick rundown of what's been on the show so far. We've had Samoa's Prime Minister, who was a no-show for his own criminal trial. We also spoke about PNG's Prime Minister, who is in Australia, set to sign the Puk Puk Treaty. But still to come, Tuvalu and Kiribati are fighting to be official members of the Oceania Football Confederation. And how are the PNG AFL team doing these days? More on those stories soon. But don't go anywhere, you're tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Te aloha nei and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It's now been 47 years since Tuvalu achieved independence from British rule, but the Oceania Football Confederation has proved to be a tougher nut to crack. No matter how hard the Tuvalu Islands Football Association has tried, it has failed to break the glass ceiling and be accepted as a full OFC member. Tifa's story is mirrored in many ways by that of KIF, their counterparts in the Kiribati Islands Football Federation, who also want to be part of OFC's grown-up family. As Richard Hewitt reports, the presidents of the two organisations met in Fiji during the OFC Futsal Cup tournament, and undaunted, both are planning to step up their membership campaigns.
Seven of OFC's 11 full member countries opted not to take part in the region's biggest futsal tournament. As an associate member only, Tuvalu were not invited, so they invited themselves, paid their own way, and made TIFA's president, Tala Sameti, proud.
Now Ionatana pulls one back. Oh, that is special. Tuvalu pull one back. It's Vanuatu 2-1.
Ionatana, the Tuvaluan goal scorer. Ionatana gets two. They still have time. They have 10 seconds.
We knew a lot of people underestimated the team and actually thought that it's going to be a walk in the park for the top teams in the region. But we proved that wrong. Football in Tuvalu is more than just a game. It brings people together in so many ways. So we want to have a fair share of the OFC and FIFA in terms of resources so that we are able to provide opportunities for footballers in Tuvalu.
The president of KIF, Arias Ribo, would love to have seen a Kiribati team on courts in Fiji too.
We don't have any invitation about this tournament. I just already send my email to OFC. If we can join the next tournament, maybe there's some sort of misunderstanding or criteria requirement.
The lack of involvement on the regional stage is deeply frustrating for the presidents when Kiribati has a national squad of some 50 11-a-side players in training. But the earliest they can expect to be in action will be at the Pacific Games in 2 years' time, where the soccer tournament is usually outside OFC's jurisdiction. Both Kiribati and Tuvalu acknowledge that they have shortcomings in terms of infrastructure, which makes it hard for them to pass OFC's admission test. But Tala Sameti says there are solutions to be found.
Becoming a member of OFC is kind of tricky, especially for countries like Tuvalu, who do not have the luxuries of resources to meet the minimum requirements. There are some within our reach and control, and there are other requirements that are far beyond our capabilities. We are in talk with Fiji Football if they can support in some of these requirements, for example, Fiji being our host country. We know that there are examples of this practice in the past, and we think this is a good model that we can follow, and we hope to reapply our membership in the future. And I hope that OFC and FIFA will have some humane consideration and exception for Tuvalu.
Right now, there is a host of nations who are members of their regional confederations and FIFA and yet don't or can't play in their own country. Timor-Leste is one. Kiribati, on the other hand, are in a position to host 11-a-side matches, and there is an invitation on the table to Tuvalu and Marshall Islands after they made their international debut in August.
Our national squad is ready. Training, they have their own schedule. That's for the men's and for the women's. We are trying
to build our connection with others. And like now, we just met Tuar. We invite them if we can come to Kiribati, because there's a big tournament, the KCCI tournament. So we try to invite Tuar and also Marshall Island. If they can afford their fare to Kiribati, we can assist them with the accommodation just to help them for their expenses. That's how we are trying to achieve it.
We are anticipating international friendly matches in the future. I spoke to the Kiribati football president, who happened to be at the OFC competition as well. We also have plans to take the teams to Fiji for a few club friendly matches. The issue we have is, of course, our funds. So until we have funding, all of these plans to develop and improve football in Tuvalu will not materialize. We love to be part of the Micronesian Federation, but at the moment, nothing official has been really communicated to us. But this, of course, help us to have more international matches and compete with countries at the same level.
So there is plenty happening, and if the Micronesian Federation becomes a reality, there would be a way forward for Tuvalu and Kiribati to take on Marshall Islands, FSM and possibly Nauru in future. That would be a positive step, but how do any of these countries solve the riddle that is being accepted at OFC's top table?
We just sent emails to the OFC development officer. Also, they just last week, they have discussing with our CEO back in Kiribati. So I think we have a very good connection now with them, but I think we have some other requirements that need to be achieved.
Looking at the history, though, of Kiribati attempting to get full membership of the OFC, is it your view that OFC have perhaps done more to find ways of not letting you in than of finding ways that would let you in? They don't seem to me, following this story for many years now, to have been terribly helpful.
I don't think of that. Maybe they have some negative ideas, decisions for Kiribati, but positively, I think they are continuing to try to help Kiribati to be part of the OFC. On our side, we will try to comply with all necessary requirements. And once we hold done, maybe they can accept us.
And Tana Sameti says Tuvalu didn't invite themselves along to the OFC Futsal Cup just to make up the numbers.
We wanted to make a point. We want to compete at the regional level, and we can compete at the regional level. OFC did not contribute to our campaign, but that doesn't matter. It did not stop us from participating. We wanted to actually prove we deserve full membership at OFC and FIFA eventually.
Off the post, individual, and into the goal. A special goal for Tuvalu. Vine gets the goal. Tuvalu.
Well, that's a goal that Tuvalu hope might just strengthen their case for full OFC membership and the chance to join the world's football family, FIFA. And the reporter there was Richard Ewart.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
For several years now, Papua New Guinea's senior national AFL teams have endured a stop-start existence. After the men's team, the Mosquitoes, won back to back international cup titles in 2014 and 2017. That tournament was put on hold in the wake of the COVID pandemic and then scrapped altogether. In its place, three new regional tournaments were introduced in 2024, with PNG taking out the inaugural Pacific Cup. But what happens next? Godwin Eke has been speaking to the AFL and AFL PNG to find out.
The 2017 International Cup proved to be the last, as a reassessment promoted by the pandemic led to a redesign which led to the creation of three new competitions in different parts of the world with the aim of developing level playing fields for all. AFL International Development Manager Ben Drew says after COVID, it was clear that things had to be done different and the old format needed to be regionalised.
So we had the Pacific Cup, Sunshine Coast. We had the Transatlantic Cup based out of Canada. And we had the Asia Cup for the first time based out of Asia. So we're able to host three really quality regional events. And then from those events, we're in the middle of, we've done a review and now we're building our international strategy. And as part of that strategy is what we're going to do with our international programs moving forward. And is excited to get an answer. We're not quite sure what that looks like. There's still a lot of work to do because we're still putting forward all our reporting on the back of our programs in the three regional events that we did host.
But players' patience would seem to be running out in PNG, where AFL Senior Football Operations Manager Rex Lecker says many of the senior players who took part in the Pacific Cup a year ago have left the squad because of the absence of international action since then. So now the team had to regroup and bring in the next generation of players from the ranks.
The PNGFL Commission has been working closely with the with a few sponsors to try to get a game, you know, maybe somewhere in the wilds, waiting for the international fixtures, trying to get games, you know, maybe up in one of the Pacific Islands or maybe in Asia, or even down in Cairns or one of the Northern Territory areas. But it all comes down to funding. This a very big task for us here up in Papua New Guinea, dealing with the rate of China that's really hitting us hard. So we need to send a full side of the AFL team down to tournaments like this. It is very costly, but we're trying all our ways and means to try and get that amount ready for us to make the next call, so that we can get our players exposed out to some fixtures out there, getting ready for the next international cup or the Pacific Cup.
Rex adds that while there are few regular events, AFL PNG is keen to pursue its talent development pathways just as it has in the past in the search for new players. And Bendru says those future players can take inspiration from Port Moresby-born Bruce Revill, a member of the victorious Brisbane Lions team in the AFL Grand Final and a great role model.
A wonderful role model for everyone in PNG, born in PNG and born in Port Moresby and grew up in Cairns and sort of White Bay area. So very good role model for everyone for all the kids coming through PNG. And I have no doubt the guys would very much love to have Bruce as a positive role model.
Back in PNG, their domestic season is heading towards finals. And in the meantime, Rex Lecker says the senior men's and women's teams are waiting patiently for a return to international competition.
And that report from Godwin Eke. Well, as we heard earlier, Queenslanders will be starting the week on a high, with both the men's and women's Brisbane Broncos teams claiming their respective premierships on Sunday. In a thrilling match, the Broncos men's team beat Melbourne Storm last night, despite trailing by 10 points at halftime. It's the team's first grand final win in 19 years, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
And Maguire is the Messiah! The 19-year drought! For the biggest club in the NRL is broken.
Sweet victory.
The Broncos are the kings of the comp once more.
In the end, the Brisbane Broncos came from behind, defeating Melbourne Storm in last night's league decider. For their loyal fans, relief and elation.
How does that feel? You're premiers.
Oh my God, how cool, Breezy. Hey. So glad we come out for it. How awesome.
For the younger supporters in the crowd, it's the first time they've seen their team win a grand final.
We've watched that heartbreaking defeat in 2023, and ever since we've just been out for redemption, and we got it tonight.
It's Brisbane's seventh premiership and its first since 2006. The Broncos were 19 points down at halftime, but despite injury and setbacks, they were able to push ahead and claim the grand final over the Storm 26-22. Queenslanders in the crowd at Stadium Australia were vindicated after years of disappointment.
I was down here for the 2015 grand final and 2023 grand final. 15-hour train down for this grand final as well. We finally got it done.
Earlier in the evening, the women's team claimed their own grand final win over the Roosters for the first time in 5 years.
Countdown is over. The Broncos are back on top of the rugby league world.
The 22-18 win was a return to form for the Queenslanders, who dominated from the outset of the women's competition, winning the league's first three premierships from 2018 to 2020. It comes just a week after the Brisbane Lions won the AFL premiership over the Geelong Cats, just the fourth club this century to win back-to-back premierships. Sports journalist Quentin Hull says Brisbane fans across the board will be celebrating.
I think there'll be a lot of people who, over the last week, have
had some pretty sore and probably rightfully so big heads in Brisbane because they're title town in Australia at the moment.
Quentin Hull says after almost two decades of waiting, the Brisbane Broncos win will be one for the books. He says Broncos fullback Reece Walsh, who claimed the Clive Churchill medal, has reached a new level of superstar, playing a pivotal role in the team's victory.
Biggest club in the land wins its first comp in 19 years at the end of a game where its two most senior players and halves in Ben Hunt and Adam Reynolds are so injured that they can't complete the match. I could keep going and going. There were flashpoints everywhere. What a game.
And that was Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat, recapping our top story in Samoa, where the government will meet for its first session of Parliament without newly elected Prime Minister Lauli Alemaliatoa Leotea Boletai Valfosi Schmidt, who is in New Zealand receiving urgent medical care.
Today, the FAST government will table their first budget. That will be the main event today.
And that's our ABC reporter in Apia, Adele Fruin. We'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again 5 p.m. this afternoon PNG time. Stay tuned, because up next it is your news, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. Until next time, o toa o vātou, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.